sounded.
Well, the radio just turned on.
I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey. It is time we begin the TechNet. And this will be TechNet number 1540 of the TechNets that began way back in September of 1982, 31 and a half years ago, something like that, 32 years ago. 31, let's see. I can't do the mathematics right now. What is the TechNet? It's a gathering of the clan, amateur radio operators, the curious ones, that want to know a little bit more about how this stuff works, how I get better use out of my transmitter, my receiver, my antenna, my tower, my generator, my portable electric power generator. We'll be discussing things like that tonight. Let me drop. Because there's a big storm coming, and we amateurs, from past history of Hurricane Irene, Superstorm Sandy, the one that occurred in 1985, Gloria, the ham radio operators do a pretty darn good job of creating a lot of communication that ordinarily wouldn't be there when you have major power outages, blizzards, snowstorms, and so on. Looks like we're going to get a pile of snow. I spent my afternoon today fixing a broken spring on my snowblower, and that broken spring was part of the idler wheel assembly that makes the wheels turn, so my snowblower wasn't going to be able to power itself if I didn't fix that. Nice job. So I'm pretty sure one of the major subjects tonight we'll be discussing is generators. What's the right size? How do you hook them up? How do you provide standby power for your radios so that you can provide the radio communication that we amateurs are famous for when it comes to disaster and difficult situations like apparently we're going to get in the next couple of days. That's our area of expertise. That's what we've gotten a darn good reputation for, and I'm pretty sure it's going to continue. In a few minutes, we're also going to have a message from Joe, W2BMP, our president. I'm going to delay that for a couple of minutes so that there are more people signed in, if you know what I mean. So, you now know partially what the TechNet does. We try to educate each other. That's the major purpose of it. We give each other information. None of the threesome here that tries to run this thing, K2RIW Dick, John KC2WGB, Paul WS2N, who gives us the space report, Hal K6DPZ, who gives us the benefit of his radio experience. None of those people, I forgot what I was going to say about them. Mind gone blank. Alrighty, the way you sign into the TechNet, because you do have a question or a comment, is you're going to give me your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment. You need not sign in just because you're listening. Let me drop. This repeater has extremely good coverage for northern New Jersey, southern New York State, western Connecticut, most of Long Island. That combined with the EchoLink connection and IRLP connections where people outside of the area also listen to the TechNet. There's a lot of people out there. And if we made the mistake of having everyone sign in because they're listening, that would be spending an awful lot of time. That's not necessarily beneficial. After 32 years, we believe somebody is listening. That doesn't have to be proven anymore. And so that group of guys tries to keep this thing running smoothly. We've got a very loose schedule where during the first hour we discuss questions and answers of a almost purely ham radio nature, though not necessarily. That's followed by John giving us, KC2WGB, giving us the mailbag. In other words, for the people who don't yet have a ham license and the right kind of equipment so that they can talk to us directly, they send him an email, snail mail email, pigeon dropping or whatever. John chooses a few of those that we know have a general interest. Let me drop. That's followed by Paul, who gives us the latest in what National Aeronautics and Space Administration is doing. And then after that, we sometimes get into deeper subjects. Not everyone's happy with the TechNet. In other words, of all the letters and cards and whatever and communications that John, Paul, and Hal and I get, a high percentage of them give us some pretty good praise. But there's a couple people out there who are unhappy. You can't please everybody. If you expect the TechNet to never have any duplications, you're going to be disappointed. I mean, the TechNet now, after those 32 years, you add it all up, it's more than 5,000 hours of TechNet. Johnny Carson was on the air every single night, so to speak, during the week for 30 solid years. The TechNet has been on the air more hours than Johnny Carson has been on the air. So in that period of time, obviously, there's going to be some duplication. Each year, somebody's going to ask a question about standing wave ratio of an antenna, for instance. And we give it a little bit of a different slant each time, but there's going to be some duplication. So people who become insulted by the duplication, or you're making an unreasonable request if you want everything to be 100% accurate for you and have absolutely no duplication. Or people go away angry because they hear something that's a duplicate. Or people who say that, gee, you guys, with all of your science studies, sometimes you're not discussing pure ham radio. And so, as I said, ham radio operators are, in my opinion, curious people. Inside of each ham radio operator, I believe, there is a scientist trying to get out. Let me drop the call. And scientists are interested in anything. And as long as you've got curiosity, you're going to make progress. The only real progress mankind has made is in the areas where they've had curiosity. How does it work? How do you make it work better and so on? Those are the kind of questions we attempt to answer. And we're not accurate all the time. We're willing to admit that every engineer has to eventually come to the conclusion that he's never going to bat 1,000. No matter how sincere, no matter how hard he tries, there's going to be some errors. And I've met a few of my fellow engineers over the years who could never admit they ever made an error. They led a very, very high-stress life, if you know what I mean. Okay, a little bit of the philosophy, as you can tell. I'm going to take call letters and names right now. A typical sign, it might sound something like this. WA2BJF, Vito and Yes. So if Vito wanted to sign in, that's what it would sound like. Give me a call letters and name. K2RAW listening.
AK1NS, Nassau County, Aries District Emergency Coordinator with the storm announcement.
AK1NS, you didn't give me a name, and we're going to go over to you right after the sign-ins with that announcement. Anyone else to sign into the TechNet, give me a call letters and name right now.
K2, Bravo, Mike, Papa, Joe with an announcement. WA2RYY, Joe. Yes. Kilo 2.
Video after red. Yeah.
Yes. Okay, we did get AJ1NS, Joe BMP, Joe RYY, and then a triple. One at a time on the triple. K2RIW listening.
KC2TUX, yes.
Mr. TUS, is that Tango Uniform Sierra? And what is your name, sir?
Kilo Charlie 2, Tango Uniform X-Ray, Bill.
Okay, we got you, Bill. Who was the other person?
Kilo 2, Mike, Victor, Romeo, Joe, Bronx, yes.
Okay, Mike, Victor, Romeo, we got you, Joe. And I think there was a third, because I did hear a triple. Is there anyone else trying to sign into the TechNet tonight? Give me a call letters and name right now.
2EO, Dick, November 2, Echo Oscar.
WS2N, Paul, yes, with a space report. Good evening to everybody.
Okay, we got Rich EO. Paul, are you signing in with a question, or just letting us doubly be sure that we know that the space report? Back to you, Paul.
Just a space report tonight, Dick.
Very fine. We got more than enough to sign in. Okay, so we're going to take them in the order. I think it was AJ1NS. I might have the call letters wrong. Please repeat your name for me, and then your message, sir. K2RIW, my name is Dick.
Thank you, Dick. This is Alpha Kilo 1, November Sierra, Dave, District Emergency Coordinator for Nassau County, Aries. Quick announcement, please. If there are any Nassau County Aries or Aries Reserve members listening to the net right now and you have not received an email from us today, please immediately email us at admin@nassaucountyaries.org. We are gearing up significantly for the storm event. Again, admin@nassaucountyaries.org. Thank you very much, Dick. AK1NS out.
Okay, that came through very well, Dave. Anyone have any further questions or need fills on what Dave just said? Give me a call, let us right now. Dave, there being none, we'll now go over to our president, Joe, W2BMP, who also has an announcement. You've got it, Joe. Yeah, it is Joe. I'm terrible at names, as you can tell. You've got it, Joe.
Thank you, Dick. Just a quick comment. Limark is running a survey, and we're interested in getting feedback for everybody on this net. You do not need to be a Limark member to participate in the survey. To get to the survey, the link is on the homepage of our website at limark.org. Let it drop. Also, we're very aggressively pursuing the abuse, interference, however you want to call it, on this repeater. If you experience any problems at all, we request that you please not engage in any unwanted interference. Instead, please report the time, your location, strength, how well they came across, to abuse@limark.org, and that comes directly to me for further investigation and the appropriate response. Thank you very much for the opportunity, Dick. Have a good evening. W2BMP, we're going to be clear.
Okay, that came through very well, Joe. So the new place to report interference is abuse@limark.org. Previously, we were reporting that to RFI and radio frequency interference at limark.org. So now the better URL is abuse@limark.org. That goes directly to Joe, gets his personal attention, and we go get him. And Lou, if you guys know Lou, NY2S, Lou has also been doing a yeoman job on making modifications to definitely aid that situation. Anyone need any fills or want to say further information about this subject, give me a call, let us right now, K2RIW and the TechNet. Go right ahead, John.
President Joe might want to give a description of that survey that's being required or being asked to take so that people know what they'll be filling out. Maybe just a quick synopsis of what it is.
Yeah, we got to worry a little bit, John. If enough people give a bad report, that's the end of the TechNet. I hope I'm joking. Over to you for any comments on this one, Joe. W2BMP, K2RIW.
We're just kind of finding out what your interests are, how we can make the repeater system better, how we can make our nets better, kind of your thoughts, any suggestions, comments. This is the world's greatest hobby. We're looking only to make it better, and just general information. And you don't need to fill out demographic information if you don't wish. Just any comments, suggestions, anything you can think of, and we also want to know how your experience is to try to make it better for you always. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, very fine, Joe. Turns out that people do make suggestions for us from time to time. The current menu or schedule, where the first hour is usually general questions, usually an hour, but sometimes longer, followed by the mailbag, followed by the space report. We came up with that menu as a evolutionary process over the years, and not everyone's happy with it. Some people want various sections to be longer, shorter, eliminated, whatever. But up till now, we thought that this particular schedule pleased the most number of people most of the time, and we're certainly open to suggestions to evolve it some more. If you want other subjects covered and so on, and other order and other magnitude set on those individual sections, you're allowed to vote on that. So by way of Joe's survey, we'll soon find out. The next person who signed in with a real question was Joe, W-A-2-R-Y-Y, one of our frequent sign-ins, a guy who's got all kinds of enthusiasm for setting up antennas and doing digital television DXing. It's a relatively rare one, but he's heard some digital television signals from time to time, some pretty far away. I'm in the process of putting some better antennas on my tower. Well, I want to join them in that process because I do watch over the television from at least the tri-state area, and in the summertime when the propagation is good, I've seen television from Maryland, Delaware, Pennsylvania, New Jersey, New York, Connecticut.
Myself a receiver.
Yeah, nice, better receiver. I also need a better antenna at a better location. That was Eric, KE2EJ. Okay, so Joe, W2RYY, K2RIW. You got it, Joe.
Good evening, Dick, W2RYY. My question for tonight is, and it's, like, it's not a stupid question, it's just that I've never used this equipment before. How does a PIM analyzer work? And the term PIM stands for Passive Intermodulation Analyzer. I know very little about this instrument. What I've seen on some of the specifications of stuff like Ritsu makes, they say the thing has an output on one of the connection jacks of plus 20 dBm to plus 43 dBm, and the battery like lasts 3 hours. So I'd like to learn a little bit more about how this thing actually works, how it makes measurements and so forth, if you know something about it. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, it is a kind of a two-tone test analyzer. So it has a little bit of similarity to the way you do a two-tone test to measure the linearity of a single sideband system, particularly the final amplifier. Got a little bit of that characteristic. It's got a lot of characteristic of a vector network analyzer and a spectrum analyzer. Now, I've worked, let's see, on for 5 solid years, I was, let's see, what was my title? Program manager? Yeah. Chief engineer, something along those lines, of the spectrum analyzer development program at Airborne Instruments Laboratory. And about 4 years ago, I spent a year of my life trying to develop a passive intermodulation distortion analyzer, PIM analyzer. And what is PIM? Let me drop. PIM performance is something that's extremely critical at a cellular telephone base station. Because the cellular telephone base station has got a whole bunch of antennas, a whole bunch of individual frequency channels, a whole bunch of transmitters, and a whole bunch of receivers. And they've all got to be compatible with each other. So that if there is the slightest amount of dissimilar metal, scratchy bolt, whatever characteristics of your connectors, your coax cable, the antenna, the rivets holding the antenna together, whatever, if there's anything that can create intermodulation distortion, measure it by putting a pair of tones, and the full performance test for a PIM test for a cell site base station is that a pair of 20 watt signals plus 43 dBm, 20 watt signals, a pair of them, at some predetermined frequency separation. The frequency separation might be a couple of megacycles. You pour that signal down your antenna system, and then you have an extremely high dynamic range, extremely well-filtered equivalent of a spectrum analyzer looking at what happens. And the performance requirement in order to not be dropping cell phone calls is that all PIM distortion, all undesired products must be suppressed by 150 decibels. That's a huge number. We're talking about many billions of one to a power ratio. In other words, if I'll just give an example. If I did a test of PIM, I might, for instance, put a pair of signals down there at 1 gig and 10 megacycles higher than 1 gig. And if there's any distortion in that system, let me drop. It would be generating a Christmas tree of other products that have the exact same separation, 10 megacycles. So in my example of 1 gig and 10 megs higher than 1 gig, there'd be another extraneous signal 20 megs higher than 1 gig and an extraneous signal 10 megs lower than 1 gig. And it might be 30 megs higher and 30 megs lower and so on. And so when you're doing a two-tone test of a linearity system, a linear amplifier for a single sideband, you're not looking for anywhere near that performance. The usual desirable performance for a single sideband amplifier is that the intermodulation distortion products are suppressed by 30 dB, 30 dB. But for
cell site, they have to be suppressed by 150 decibels. At around 135 or around 140, you start dropping cell phone calls. And the really fancy PIM testers not only measure the magnitude of the PIM, but they also can give you distance to fault. You'd like to know that the thing that's generating the PIM is 10 feet downrange on that cable or 100 feet downrange. If it's 100 feet downrange, it's something that's going on the top of the tower. If it's 10 feet downrange, it might be the feed-through connector that's on the base station housing, if you know what I mean. I think Eric said he's got some further words on this, and give us those words, Eric. KE2EJ, K2REW in the TechNet.
K2REW, K2EJ. I'm just wondering how realistic minus 150 dBm is. I mean, if you're saying minus 150 dBc, that's another story, but minus 150 dBm, that's asking for a lot.
Okay, I said the PIM products are suppressed by 150 dB. I didn't say 150 dBm. I should have said 150 dBc. So the PIM products are 150 dB lower than each of the original signals of plus 20 watts. It's still an extremely difficult test to do because in the early days of really good spectrum analyzers, the Hewlett-Packard 8555, for instance, which in its day it was state-of-the-art, it had something like 70 or 80 dB of dynamic range on the screen. The AIL Model 707 spectrum analyzer, which came out in, I guess it was roughly 1969 or so, I was part of the development team of that thing, was the first one that had 100 dB of dynamic range on screen. To get more than 100 dB dynamic range on screen of something like a spectrum analyzer is way beyond the state of the art of instantaneous dynamic range on the screen. As such, the PIM tester also needs extremely high quality filtering to filter out the two original signals, 1,000 megs and 10 megs, higher than 1,000 megs, in my example, and yet look at everything else that's left over. If you can suppress the two starting signals by 50 decibels by fancy filtering and let everything else pass through, and if that everything else is going into something with 100 dB of dynamic range, then you can achieve the 150 dB of requirement to make the measurement. And the usual failure, let me drop this, is an improperly connected, installed connector on the end of the hardline cable, dissimilar metals on the interface of male and female connector, wherever they occur. You have to choose really good connectors. The 7/16 connectors that are being used almost exclusively at cell sites, as long as you choose the right brand name with the right kind of materials and coatings and whatever, you don't run into the problem. However, you can take even a very good brand of connector, and because you do a lot of troubleshooting of that system and you connect and disconnect that connector a whole lot of times, and you wear away the precious coatings, whether it be silver plating, nickel plating, or whatever, and the stainless steel underneath and so on, you can start running into a problem. It's even possible that a failure of a lightning arrestor that's in the system. I've seen failures where the rivets in the antenna were not completely tight, and they were acting like a rusty bolt. And I'll give you one other example of what I'm talking about here. This very guy, Joe, W-H-O-R-Y-Y, ran into a very interesting experiment in physics. He was testing the quality of a base station antenna combined with his repeater system. And he wanted to do a test at home before he ran it up to the top of the mountain, so to speak. So he mounted the base station antenna on the top of a nice steel post in his backyard, which happened to be the steel post holding up a chain link fence. At first that sounds okay, but if you think about that chain link fence, it's got a whole lot of intermediate contacts. In other words, two chunks of steel rubbed against each other. With the slightest amount of wind blowing or shaking or whatever, those act like a rusty nail. And now when you're testing a repeater and your transmitter on the repeater is putting out 50 watts and you want the receiver to listen to a signal that's 120 dB weaker, the rusty nail effect of the chain link fence can desensitize your receiver. And Joe at the time was quite amazed that his apparent sensitivity of the receiver was very different when the transmitter was turned on versus the transmitter being turned off, even though the duplexing filter was working like a charm, even though the transmitter was well aligned, wasn't putting out spurs, but the fence itself was making spurs. So that a rusty nail alongside of your antenna on the tower can do things like this. But we hams, to suppress the undesired intermodulation products, let me drop them. To suppress them by 30 dB for ham radio operation is usually good enough. In the case of a repeater, you want those undesired products to be suppressed by something like 100, 110, maybe 120 dB. But for a cell phone, they need 150 dBc, 150 dB of suppression compared to the two main signals. An extremely difficult performance requirement, and there's a lot of man hours being spent every day at all the cell sites across the United States checking on whether or not that performance is being met, and if it's not being met, going through a fairly difficult analysis process to find out where the bad guy is. That's some of the information on that subject, Joe. W2RYY, K2IW, the TechNet.
Okay, I remember the test that was done when I was working on the backyard with the repeater antenna. That is quite interesting. And but here's something else I did that I don't know if you remember what happened. I think specifically with that particular test, I was transmitting off of the antenna mounted on the fence. I was using that actually as a repeater antenna, transmitting and receiving off that antenna, and I was using a signal generator to simulate a low-level signal coming into to that repeater antenna at a distance away, and that antenna was up on my house at the time at about linear distance of about 50 or 60 feet away. Yes, I remember when you shook the fence, it made the signal on the into repeater antenna end up with a lot of static. But do you also remember that when I closed my garage door, it did the same thing? Now that was about 30 feet away from the repeater antenna. How would you go and find a problem like that, where it's not even near the repeater antenna, it's quite a ways away, you're trying to you listen to a weak signal on your repeater, and something mechanically moves into 30-42 FM antenna, and it generates this kind of noise. How would you go about tracking that? I don't know if these PIM analyzers can do that kind of stuff or not. That's why I asked the question basically to begin with. Back to you, Dick.
In the case of my garage door, maybe it's similar to yours, you've got a metal track, you've got metal wheels that slide across that track, which then move the door. You've also got this great big spring, and the spring is a metallic object scraping against things as the door is being moved. So even though it's 30 feet away, because maybe the pancake pattern, the high gain pattern out of your base station antenna, was squirting a fair amount of signal to that thing, you may have been unlucky in that the length of the track of your garage door system happened to be a harmonic of 2 meters, so to speak, and so therefore it picked up a whole lot of signal as an antenna. I'm speculating. But yes, there are times when a PIM failure, a intermodulation distortion failure, with a transmitting system that's doing simultaneous transmitting and receiving from the same antenna, it's a rather sensitive system to things like this. The worst case along these lines that NASA ever ran into is that in the early days of the Apollo program, where you've got the 210-foot, and that day it became 240 later, 210-foot diameter dish, the Mars number 14 base station at Goldstone, California, in the middle of the Mojave Desert at Fort Irwin is where it's literally located. I went to that site. Okay, that 210-foot diameter dish antenna was tracking the Apollo astronauts, transmitting a signal to them with about 10 kilowatts and listening to the signal coming back from the astronauts. And because that antenna has a whole bunch of metal panels on the parabolic reflector that are held together with rivets, on a windy day, they ran into the problem where the antenna is being shifted a little bit, the rivets are rubbing against each other, or the metal panels are rubbing against each other, and you periodically get blasts of noise in the downlink signal from the astronauts. Let me drop. So even well-equipped people who understand the problem occasionally run into it. And so a high-power transmitter, simultaneous transmitting and receiving from the same antenna system, can give you this grief. And that's on the assumption your transmitter is well aligned. And if your transmitter is a little bit out of alignment so that it's putting out some signal at the receiver frequency, which is, you know, in the case of NASA, it's 100 megs away, it can still give you grief. So, who's got a comment on this one?
KC2WGB.
You got it, Charlie.
Yeah, that's very interesting. I'd like to know from Joe, the garage door, I'm sure it was a folding type door, not a solid door. Was it fiberglass, wood?
You got it, Joe, when they enter the beep.
Fiberglass.
But the storm, most likely there were metal wheels rubbing against a metal track with a metal spring that supports the garage door. I've made some guesses. Am I close, Joe?
Yes, you are correct.
So, this gives you a little bit of rundown on PIM. There's a lot more to it. And so I'm going to move on now. And interesting subject, Joe, one of the ones that I spent a year and a half of my life trying to develop that particular piece of equipment that could measure PIM 150 dB down. The first thing that I recognized when starting to test that piece of equipment is that any piece of braided cable, flexible cable, RG8, RG214, RG9, even silver-plated, double-shielded flexible cable, if that is anywhere in the system and anything moves it, you'll fail the PIM test. You start developing products that are 120, 130 dB down on a spec that's got to be 150 dB. So just the individual fibers of the braid of a coax cable being flexed and rubbing against each other will cause you to fail that test. You can see that all the cabling in the cell site is hardline. None of it is going to be, none of it in the transmitter path is going to have braided cable, if you know what I mean.
Bill, question, Dick?
Yeah, go ahead, John.
I find that interesting because we had a similar problem, and it was a static discharge from the plastic doors to the track that was causing a problem with a radio. But I was just wondering if that's, what do you think of that, Dick?
Yeah, one of the things that I was doing during that PIM investigation, the portable passive intermodulation distortion analyzer test set that we were trying to build, one of the things that I did was to run a Wimhurst machine. John will understand that because he owns a Wimhurst machine. And if you go to QSZ.com and you plug in KC2WGB and you look at the beautiful pieces of equipment in his laboratory, one of them is a Wimhurst machine. These are two great big 10-inch diameter plastic wheels that rotate against each other and generate very high voltages. And when I ran that Wimhurst machine anywhere in the vicinity of an antenna system that's undergoing a PIM test, you would fail the test immediately. So static electricity, static discharge, produces radio frequency noise components that literally go DC to light. They go across the whole darn spectrum, depending on what's the rise time and the amount of capacitance and the length of the leads that's doing the static discharge. You'll go up to certain frequencies and then start falling off. I mean, if I look at the frequencies coming out of that Wimhurst machine when it's making a sparking, arcing and sparking, my guess is the static components are reasonably strong up to roughly 1 gigahertz, and they probably fall off 6 dB per octave beyond that point. But they never go to zero. Let me drop. So anything that's making static discharge, you'll notice that on certain kinds of rainy nights or certain kinds of snow falling, gives you a static a buildup on an antenna. And so this particular repeater sometimes will give you a scratchy sound, a clicking sound, because of static discharge in certain kinds of rain and snowstorms. So our repeater system is extremely sensitive to that kind of interference. I'm going to go on to Bill now, KC2TUX, and for anybody who looks him up on QSZ.com, there's a beautiful picture of him, and I'm guessing his wife, and I'm guessing that's your wedding picture. KC2TUX, K2RIW, you got it, Bill.
Yes, you're correct. That is my beautiful wife there, Kilo Charlie 2, Tango X-ray Sierra. She doesn't use her call sign too often, though. That's my fault because I don't have a radio inside, I guess. My question for the TechNet, and please try to keep it fairly simple, as I am fairly simple myself. Sort of an antenna question. I removed an Alpha Delta antenna DXCC model for maintenance after we've been using it for about 4 years. I installed a G5RV this past Thursday. We used it for a couple of days, used it Thursday and Friday, sometime on Saturday, using it a lot for testing voice and data using an SCS PTC USB modem. The voice that we did was all low power due to the closeness of the antennas. But when I installed the G5RV, what I did was I attached the coax to a guy wire going to a exhaust vent. Let me drop it. I don't know how long I've been keying up. A heater exhaust vent, the steel cable going right to a metal vent. And later on Saturday, while we were tuning up the radio, the antenna tuner burnt out. Now, I was curious if having that, if the coax connector was touching that wire, could that be affecting the performance or what the radio is seeing as the antenna and cause it to have some sort of an issue causing the tuner to in turn burn out.
When you installed the G5RV, Bill, what motivated you to connect its coax cable to a guy wire where the guy wire went to a heater exhaust vent? What motivated you to make that connection, Bill? Go ahead.
Well, I knew that the line coming down from the center conductor is the open ladder line, I believe it's called 450 ohm ladder line. I knew that needed to be away from any conductive material. I didn't realize it was only a few inches away. I thought it would needed to be further away, so I pulled the base of it away and it just reached that almost perfectly with a little bit of slack in the ladder line. So I want, because the center mast is attached to a generator, and I wanted it to be away from that. So I just pulled it to the side. It was like maybe 6 feet away from the base of the antenna mast, so it looked like the easiest thing to do.
Did you make that connection for mechanical and support reasons, or did you do it for electronic reasons? Did you make an electrical connection, or did you just use that guy wire as a support for the cable? Back to you, Bill.
I just made it just for the, to keep that 450 ohm wire away from anything. I did not do it for an electrical connection, but I was, the thought passed through my head that if that's outside of the coax connector is touching that, it could cause it to affect the antenna.
When you were using your antenna tuner and that antenna system, did you sense at any time that while you were using it, it was doing a lot of hunting? That as you switched bands, QSYs, or even just stayed in one frequency, did you hear or see indication that your antenna tuner was going through a realignment periodically? Back to you, Bill.
Notice anything different other than when we were tuning up? It wasn't doing anything on its own unless I hit the tune button on the face of the radio.
And when you hit that tune button and the antenna tuner did its thing, did you have indication that it arrived at what it thought was a satisfactory tuning, and did your transmitter therefore see a fairly low standing wave ratio? Over to you, Bill.
Yes, everything seemed normal, and I've been doing this for a few years with this. This is a Mars radio for a government agency. I've been doing this for years. It sounded fine up until right before I started smelling the smoke, and I was listening to it. I said, something's not right while we were tuning. and I should have taken that as a strong hint and researched and see what was going on. Then we tuned it up one more time on a different frequency, and that's when the smoke came out.
Now, a G5RV is famous for having rather good standing wave ratio on almost every band except 10 meters. And the many embodiments of a G5RV, a Louvarnia antenna, have fairly high Viswa on 10 meters, which would give you a more difficult impedance matching. In other words, your antenna tuner has to work harder. Under normal circumstances, a well-constructed antenna tuner is very good at self-protecting. Under certain tuning conditions, the amount of current flowing in the inductor, the main inductor, is going to be high enough to create some heating. And under certain tuning conditions, you may get some arcing across the capacitor. But for the real tuning elements themselves to burn up is extremely unusual. However, your antenna tuner is probably an automatic one, which means it has motors, servo mechanism type motors, that are being told to turn clockwise, counterclockwise, go this far, and stop. When you do finally analyze and do troubleshooting of your antenna tuner, I am guessing there's a high probability you had a motor failure or a motor drive circuit failure, in which case it's not really an antenna tuner failure. I mean, not the antenna tuner function. Go ahead, Eric.
I don't know what kind of tuner you're talking about here, but many of the modern day tuners don't have the motorized capacitors anymore. It's all relays.
All relays. Okay. Have you started the analysis, Bill, so that you know what failed? Was it one of the inductors and capacitors that does the tuning? Was it a relay and relay drive circuit? Where did the smoke come out, so to speak, if you happen to know? Over to you, Bill.
All I did was opened it up, and it looked like like I said, I'm simple, so let me try and explain this the best that I can. I have the tuner with me. It's an LDG IP100. I don't have it opened in front of me, though. There's some, like, toroid coils, cores, circular, with wires wrapped around them. One of them looks, the ones all the way on the right-hand side, if they have, like, a brown coating over the center, and then the ones all the way on the left side were burnt. It was obvious that that was where the excessive heat was, but I do not know enough to go in there and start disconnecting, unsoldering, and checking individual components to determine what the failure was.
Bill, what band were you on when you had the failure?
Right around 8 megahertz.
Okay. I didn't know there's a ham band at 8 megahertz. Bring me up to speed on that one, Bill.
Mars. The radio is modified to operate on Mars frequencies.
Does the tuner go there?
Oh, the plot thickens. The Louvarnia antenna, the G5RV, you could say it is designed to work on 40, 20, 15, and 10. Don't think it's designed to work on 8 megs. As such, you could have a huge standing wave ratio on 8 megs, in which case the antenna tuner is possibly being used beyond specification. I mean, your particular antenna tuner probably has a specification that says we don't guarantee the performance above a 6 to 1 standing wave ratio. And maybe your antenna gave it a 20 to 1 standing wave ratio, which could really push it. Let's see what Eric's got to say on this one, because Eric, it sounds to me like you're familiar with that product. KE2EJ, our local broadcast engineer, K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW, K2EJ. I can tell you for sure that the G5RV doesn't really like to resonate around 8 megahertz. The tuner that he's got probably expects to, end at 7.3 at the top of 40 meters. So he's asking it to do something that there's probably not enough inductive reactions to make. That's why one of the toroid chokes.
Question, Dick. Yeah, John recognized. One of the things that was discovered by W2FMI, can't think of his name right now, a man who had a, he's a silent key. He had a series of articles on building a mechanically small antennas, ground plane antennas on 80 and 40 meters. And he was doing a lot of impedance matching in his articles in QSD magazine using toroids. And he did discover that certain kinds of ferrite toroids, when pushed beyond manufacturer's limit, create extra heating of the core. The extra heating of the core creates some kind of a permanent change in the ferrite material, which in turn creates a greater heating later on. It becomes a runaway condition. So an antenna not rated for 8 megacycles, an antenna tuner not rated for 8 megacycles, the two put together, the possibility of extremely high standing wave ratio at, I'm going to guess, 100 watts of power rating, could be a combination that really put your antenna tuner at grief. You've gone pretty far beyond what I believe is the manufacturer's specification for that antenna tuner. So there's some lessons to be learned here. And by the way, this is a recoverable situation. It's not the end of the world. KC2WGB with some further information. K2LIW, go ahead, John.
KC2WGB. Yes, Dick, I'd like to know, is this the first attempt at using that setup, or had he been using it before, which I don't think was mentioned? Back to you, Dick.
We're going to turn it back to you, Bill, for how many watts were you transmitting, how long were you doing it, had you done it before, and did it fail in the first 10 minutes on 8 megacycles, so to speak? KC2TUX, K2RIW, interesting situation.
When we transmit for the data using the modem, we usually run it at 100 watts. Like I had said, I had been using for the past few years an Alpha Delta antenna. I had said that at the very beginning, a VXCC model with the same exact radio and tuner with no issues. Thursday, we installed the G5RV in the morning. We pinged a whole bunch of RMS stations all day Thursday with no issues. Friday we were doing voice with low power, completely low power because the antennas were so close. And then Saturday we went back to testing data. So it wasn't the very first time that I transmitted in that on that frequency over those 3 days that we were running it.
Bill, I'm going to guess that the data mode is a very high duty mode, a little bit like a radio teletype, so to speak. And so the transmitter, I'm going to guess, maybe was running in the 100 watt category and almost running key down because you're sending data. So the combination of a G5RV that, had you rated its bare standing wave ratio at 8 megs, the G5RV could have had a 20 to 1 standing wave ratio. It may be even higher. And that poor antenna tuner, I think, was being pushed to the max of extremely high bizwar, extremely high duty factor, 100 watts of power, and I think that's what did it in. And so quite possibly those individual components that got burned are replaceable, but it does sound to me like the G5RV is not the right antenna for that particular service. I'm back to you, Bill. And by the way, as you do the analysis, repair, reset up on this, I'd like you to come back and tell us what you've discovered, because this is an interesting case. KC2TUX, K2RIW, the TechNet.
I think everything that you said actually makes sense to me. I was amazed that you didn't go far over my head, and I thank you for that. I'm going to play around with it. I know LDG makes other tuners for higher wattage. Assuming that would assist it, I will watch the SWRs more closely. I don't check them all the time because obviously I just assume that they're good enough with the tuner. I do not have an SWR meter. I'm going to look and see if I can pick one up for my own personal use then when I go in to operate the Mars station at the agency. I will I'll watch it more closely. If you want any, detailed information, you can send an email to my call sign at gmail.com, and I'll try and keep you up to date on it. Thank you very much for all your time, Dick, John, and Eric. I appreciate it. Have a great afternoon. KC2TUX.
All comments, Dick.
Yeah, Eric recognized. Some antenna tuners will have a rotary switch on the front panel where you can select various modes of operation, where you can switch it into a mode where it tells you what is the raw standing wave ratio of the antenna, and then in another mode, you can switch it where it tells you what standing wave ratio will be seen by your transmitter looking into the antenna tuner. Some of them will have that mode, and standing wave ratio can be measured a whole lot of ways. If you owned a bird watt meter or its equivalent, and you can measure forward power and reverse power on the antenna. There's a simple formula or a bunch of lookup graphs that allow you to convert that ratio of forward and reverse power into standing wave ratio. So, and I guarantee there are various friends of yours where you can borrow a bird watt meter, a standing wave ratio meter, an antenna analyzer, any of these things that are capable of measuring raw antenna VISWA. And when you do make that measurement on your G5RV, I'd like to hear about it because Eric and I are both predicting that its raw standing wave ratio could be extremely high. KE2EJ, K2RIW, go ahead, Eric.
K2RIW, K2EJ. I just want to point out something. In a lot of cases, the lacquer on the, it's actually on the core. The core gets freaking hot, and that's what gives off the smoke. It doesn't necessarily mean that it opened, although the inductance in the Q of it changed, the coil changed. But, chances are you go into the regular handband with it, the thing will still work. It just melts the contacts on the relay. So. And the type of tuner that he's talking about is completely microprocessor. I don't know what the individual functions are on the front of it, but well, he could tell you that. K2RIWK.
Yeah, downrange, as Bill does more investigation, we'll find out more about this. And we're looking forward to hearing from you some more, Bill. You do have a very interesting case. I think of all of the antenna tuners we've heard about on the TechNet, don't think we've ever had one burn up before. So you're the first. Okay, the next person who signed in with a question was Rich, N2EO, and then Joe after that from the Bronx. Rich, N2EO, go right ahead. T2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, good evening, Dick, N2EO. Before I continue, am I making it okay with the handheld?
A little bit noisy, but we're hearing all your words. Please proceed.
Hey, Dick, very good. As you know, the whole shack is ripped apart because we're starting the construction here, so I've got no handshack right now. Dick, I was on the net earlier. I don't know if you were listening. It's kind of a very broad question, but and a little too late to do right now, but maybe for the summer or the spring, I would very much like to, if I could afford it, to put in a automatic start generator. It has to be automatic start because, you know, my situation. I'm in a wheelchair right now, and I'm wondering if there's any financial help with, what do they call themselves, National Grid. Myself and Patricia both are disabled, and we live on a four-year-old child in the house, Patty's grandson. So, like I say, it's a very broad question, and what does a thing like that cost, soup to nuts and salt with a transfer switch? I think you need permits for that. I'm not sure, but I'm in the town of Oyster Bay. Yeah,
I'm going to temporarily bypass you, Rich, because we've got this huge weather situation coming up on Monday and Tuesday. One of the things that we've discussed for many TechNets right after Superstorm Sandy was the generator situation, standby power. Uninterruptible power supply systems, motor generator sets, powered by diesel, powered by gasoline, powered by natural gas, what size, how many kilowatts to run a house, and so on. That's a whole subject that I think we should discuss tonight. because of what's going to happen in the next couple of days. So I'm going to take Joe's question next, MVR, and then after that, we're going to go into this discussion, which I think we should do because of what's about to happen. K2MVR. Joe, K2LAW. Right ahead with your question, Joe.
Yes, K2IW, K2MVR. Good evening to you and everybody in the net. I'll keep it short and quick. I actually posted a picture of the question at my website at QRZ. So that first picture there will describe what I'm going to ask. I'm at a four stories up, facing east. And I have a row of trees that are at my height, four stories up. I would like to operate, try the band 60, 80, and 160 meters with my KX3. I would just like to know a ballpark figure of what length of wire you might recommend that I toss out there. I have at least 200 feet. If you look at those trees there from my window, and they're at eye level, like I said, at the fourth floor. I have a 921 Unun toroid matching transformer, but I've only used that with 30 feet of wire going vertical. So I'm planning to do this horizontal, and that's basically my question. What do you think, Dick or anybody else?
Yeah, it's a very nice picture of your QTH in the Bronx with the moving trucks out in front. I guess that's when you were moving in or somebody else was moving. Now, I think you're saying that you're going to hang a wire out the window, I presume at nighttime where it's not seen. In other words, you don't have access to the roof, you don't have access to the normal support structures where, if this is the best of all worlds, you'd like to hang a dipole between the your fire escape and another building 130 feet away, so to speak. So run by one more time. What do you believe is the maximum amount of hardware, antenna-like hardware, that you're allowed to hang outside of your building? Four stories up implies you're 40 feet up, so that if it was just a piece of wire hanging straight down, it does sound like it's going to be touching the ground in 45 feet, so to speak. So what band... And what do you think you're allowed in wires before we start trying to make a suggestion as to how you can get the best bang for the dollar, so to speak? Joe, K2MVR in the Bronx. In the Bronx, K2RW in the TechNet.
Yeah, Dick, the roof is off limits, basically. I mean, there's access up there, but I don't want to break any rules. I could just put some hardware outside the window, which I have already, where I already hang my Alex Loop antenna, and I have a couple of supports there. That's basically what I could use. I was planning to have an NFED going straight out, and it's about, I have no buildings behind me. It's an empty parking lot, not an empty parking lot, a parking space or parking lot. And it goes straight out about 200 feet all the way to the sidewalk.
What's your favorite band you'd like to be able to operate on is question number one, Joe. Also, if you strung a piece of wire from your apartment as a sloper out toward that parking lot, are there any supports out there you might be able to use? A lighting post, a telephone pole, or whatever. Is there any other supports out there you could use? This is a long shot, but I just want to make sure we haven't left any stone unturned. So once again, which band, and do you think you could string a sloper wire out there? Over to you, Joe, K2MVR, K2LAW, the TechNet.
Yeah, I'm interested in trying 60, 80, and 160 meters. Those three bands, I've really never worked them. I do most of my work with the Alex Loop on CW, and that pretty much works for me very well. But I would like to try those three bands, 60, 80, and 160. And nowhere to attach. I would have to rely on putting, you know, like an end weight on the wire, and after tossing it and stringing it through, just the weight of it. And that's basically it. I mean, the picture basically says it all there. If